Summer adventures are better with Minky Couture. From road trips to ball games, beach nights to backyard movies, Minky has you covered. Don't miss the Everywhere blanket. Water-resistant, ultra-soft, and made for life on the go. Wherever summer takes you, bring comfort along. MinkyCouture.com, the original best blanket ever.
Section 16 of The Secret of the Night by Gaston Leroux. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Don W. Jenkins. Chapter 16. Before the Revolutionary Tribunal. Only Rouletabille refused to be put into the basket. He would not let them disarm him until they promised to call a carriage. The vehicle rolled into the court, and while Pere Alexis was kept back in his shop at the point of a revolver, Rouletabille quietly got in, smoking his pipe. The man who appeared to be the chief of the band, the gentleman of the Neva, got in, too, and sat down beside him. The carriage windows were shuttered, preventing all communication with the outside, and only a tiny lantern lighted the interior. They started. The carriage was driven by two men in brown coats trimmed with false astrakhan. The dvorniks saluted, believing it a police affair. The concierge made the sign of the cross. The journey lasted several hours without other incidents than those brought about by the tremendous jolts which threw the two passengers inside, one on top of the other. This might have made an opening for conversation, and the gentleman of the Neva tried it, but in vain. Rouletabille would not respond. At one moment, indeed, the gentleman who was growing bored became so pressing that the reporter finally said, in the curt tone he always used when he was irritated, "I pray, monsieur, let me smoke my pipe in peace." Upon which the gentleman prudently occupied himself in lowering one of the windows, for it grew stifling. Finally, after much jolting, there was a stop while the horses were changed, and the gentleman asked Rouletabille to let himself be blindfolded. "The moment has come. They are going to hang me without any form of trial," thought the reporter. And when, blindfolded with the bandage, he felt himself lifted under the arms, there was revolt of his whole being, that being which, now that it was on the point of dying, did not wish to cease. Rouletabille would have believed himself stronger, more courageous, more stoical at least. But blind instinct swept all of this away, that instinct of conservation which had no concern with the minor bravados of the reporter, no concern with the fine heroic manner of the determined pose to die finally, because the instinct of conservation, which is, as its rigid name indicates, essentially materialistic, demands only, thinks of nothing but, to live. And it was that instinct which made Rouletabille's last pipe die out unpuffed. The young man was furious with himself, and he grew pale with the fear that he might not succeed in mastering this emotion. He took fierce hold of himself and his members, which had stiffened at the contact of seizure by rough hands, relaxed, and he allowed himself to be led. Truly, he was disgusted with his faintness and weakness. He had seen men die who knew they were going to die. His task as reporter had led him more than once to the foot of the guillotine, and the wretches he had seen there had died bravely. Extraordinarily enough, the most criminal had ordinarily met death most bravely. Of course, they had had leisure to prepare themselves, thinking a long time in advance of that supreme moment. But they affronted death, came to it almost negligently, found strength even to say banal or taunting things to those around them. He recalled, above all, a boy of 18 years old who had cowardly murdered an old woman and two children in a back-country farm, and had walked to his death without a tremor, talking reassuringly to the priest and the police official who walked almost sick with horror on either side of him. Could he, then, not be as brave as that child? They made him mount some steps, and he felt that he had entered the stuffy atmosphere of a closed room. Then someone removed the bandage. He was in a room of sinister aspect, and in the midst of a rather large company. Within these naked, neglected walls there were about 30 young men, some of them apparently quite as young as Rouletabille, with candid blue eyes and pale complexions. The others, older men, were of the physical type of Christs, not the animated Christs of Occidental painters, but those that are seen on the panels of the Byzantine school or fastened on the icons, sculptures of silver or gold. Their long hair, deeply parted in the middle, fell upon their shoulders in curl-tipped golden masses. Some leaned against the wall, erect and motionless. Others were seated on the floor, their legs crossed. Most of them were in winter coats, bought in the bazaars. But there were also men from the country, with their skins of beasts, their seons, their tulips. One of them had his legs laced about with cords and was shod with twined willow twigs. The contrast afforded by various ones of these grave and attentive figures showed that representatives from the entire revolutionary party were present. At the back of the room, behind a table, three young men were seated, and the oldest of them was not more than 25 and had the benign beauty of Christ on feast days, canopied by consecrated palms. In the center of the room a small table stood, quite bare and without any apparent purpose. On the right was another table with paper, pens, and inkstands. It was there that Rouletabille was conducted and asked to be seated. Then he saw that another man was at his side who was required to keep standing. His face was pale and desperate, very drawn. His eyes burned somberly. In spite of the panic that deformed his features, Rouletabille recognized one of the unintroduced friends whom Gounsovski had brought with him to the supper at Krestowsky. Evidently, since then, the always threatening misfortune had fallen upon him. They were proceeding with his trial. The one who seemed to preside over these strange sessions pronounced a name. "Annouchka!" A door opened, and Annouchka appeared. Rouletabille hardly recognized her. She was so strangely dressed, like the Russian poor, with her under-jacket of red flannel and the handkerchief which, knotted under her chin, covered all her beautiful hair. She immediately testified in Russian against the man, who protested until they compelled him to be silent. She drew from her pocket papers which were read aloud and which appeared to crush the accused. He fell back onto his seat. He shivered. He hid his head in his hands, and Rouletabille saw the hands tremble. The man kept that position while the other witnesses were heard, their testimony arousing murmurs of indignation that were quickly checked. Annouchka had gone to take her place with the others against the wall, in the shadows which more and more invaded the room at this ending of a lugubrious day. Two windows reaching to the floor let a wan light creep with difficulty through their dirty panes, making a vague twilight in the room. Soon nothing could be seen of the motionless figures against the wall, much as the faces fade in the frescoes from which the centuries have effaced the colors in the depths of Orthodox convents. Now someone from the depths of the shadow and the appalling silence read something. The verdict, doubtless. The voice ceased. Then some of the figures detached themselves from the wall and advanced. The man who crouched near Rouletabille rose in a savage bound and cried out rapidly, wild words, supplicating words, menacing words. And then nothing more but strangling gasps. The figures that had moved out from the wall had clutched his throat. The reporter said, "It is cowardly." Annouchka's voice, low from the depths of the shadow, replied, "It is just." But Rouletabille was satisfied with having said that, for he had proved to himself that he could still speak. His emotion had been such since they had pushed him into the center of this sinister and expeditious revolutionary assembly of justice that he thought of nothing but the terror of not being able to speak to them, to say something to them, no matter what, which would prove to them that he had no fear. Well, that was over. He had not failed to say, "That is cowardly," and he crossed his arms. But he soon had to turn away his head in order not to see the use the table was put to that stood in the center of the room where it had seemed to serve no purpose. They had lifted the man, still struggling, up onto the little table. They placed a rope about his neck. Then one of the judges, one of the blonde young men who seemed no older than Rouletabille, climbed on the table and slipped the other end of the rope through a great ring bolt that projected from a beam of the ceiling. During this time the man struggled futilely, and his death-rattle rose at last through the continuing noise of his resistance and its overcoming. But his last breath came with so violent a shake of the body that the whole death-apparatus, rope and ring-bolt, separated from the ceiling and rolled to the ground with the dead man. Rouletabille uttered a cry of horror. "You are assassins!" he cried. But was the man surely dead? It was this that the pale figures with yellow hair set themselves to make sure of. He was. Then they brought two sacks, and the dead man was slipped into one of them. Rouletabille said to them, "You are braver when you kill by an explosion, you know." He regretted bitterly that he had not died the night before in the explosion. He did not feel very brave. He talked to them bravely enough, but he trembled as his time approached. That death horrified him. He tried to keep from looking at the other sack. He took the two icons, of St. Luke and of the Virgin, from his pocket and prayed to them. He thought of the lady in black and wept. A voice in the shadows said, "He is crying, the poor little fellow." It was Annouchka's voice. Rouletabille dried his tears and said, "Messieurs, one of you must have a mother." But all the voices cried, "No, no, we have mothers no more." "They have killed them," cried some. "They have sent them to Siberia," cried others. "Well, I have a mother still," said the poor lad. "I will not have the opportunity to embrace her. It is a mother that I lost the day of my birth and that I have found again. But I suppose it is to be said, on the day of my death, I shall not see her again. I have a friend. I shall not see him again either. I have two little icons here for them, and I am going to write a letter to each of them, if you will permit it. Swear to me that you will see these reach them."
"I swear it," said in French the voice of Annouchka.
"Thanks, madam. You are kind. And now, messieurs, that is all I ask of you. I know I am here to reply to very grave accusations. Permit me to say to you at once that I admit them all to be well-founded. Consequently, there need be no discussion between us. I have deserved death, and I accept it. So permit me not to concern myself with what will be going on here. I ask of you simply, as a last favor, not to hasten your preparations too much, so that I may be able to finish my letters." Upon which, satisfied with himself this time, he sat down again and commenced to write rapidly. They left him in peace, as he desired. He did not raise his head once, even at the moment when a murmur louder than usual showed that the hearers regarded Rouletabille's crimes with especial detestation. He had the happiness of having entirely completed his correspondence once, when they asked him to rise to hear judgment pronounced upon him. The supreme communion that he had just had with his friend Sainclair and with the dear lady in black restored all his spirit to him. He listened respectfully to the sentence which condemned him to death, though he was busy sliding his tongue along the gummed edge of his envelope. These were the counts on which he was to be hanged. 1. Because he had come to Russia and mixed in affairs that did not concern his nationality, and had done this in spite of warning to remain in France. 2. Because he had not kept the promises of neutrality he freely made to a representative of the Central Revolutionary Committee. 3. For trying to penetrate the mystery of the Trebisov dacha. 4. For having Comrade Mathieu whipped and imprisoned by Koupriane. 5. For having denounced to Koupriane the identity of the two doctors who had been assigned to kill General Trebisov. 6. For having caused the arrest of Natasha Feodorovna. It was a list longer than was needed for his doom. Rouletabille kissed his icons and handed them to Annouchka along with the letters. Then he declared, with his lips trembling slightly and a cold sweat on his forehead, that he was ready to submit to his fate. End of chapter 16. Read by Don W. Jenkins, Rancho San Diego, California, shaggybark.blogspot.com. Section 17 of The Secret of the Night by Gaston Leroux. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Don W. Jenkins. Chapter 17. The Last Cravat. The gentleman of the Neva said to him, "If you have nothing further to say, we will go into the courtyard." Rouletabille understood at last that hanging him in the room where judgment had been pronounced was rendered impossible by the violence of the prisoner just executed. Not only the rope and the ring-bolt had been torn away, but part of the beam had splintered. "There is nothing more," replied Rouletabille. He was mistaken. Something occurred to him. An idea flashed so suddenly that he became white as his shirt, and had to lean on the arm of the gentleman of the Neva in order to accompany him. The door was open. All the men who had voted his death filed out in gloomy silence. The gentleman of the Neva, who seemed charged with the last offices for the prisoner, pushed him gently out into the court. It was vast and surrounded by a high board wall. Some small buildings with closed doors stood to right and left. A high chimney, partially demolished, rose from one corner. Rouletabille decided the whole place was part of some old abandoned mill. Above his head the sky was pale as a winding sheet. A thunderous, intermittent, rhythmical noise appraised him that he could not be far from the sea. He had plenty of time to note all these things, for they had stopped the march to execution a moment and had made him sit down in the open courtyard on an old box. A few steps away from him, under the shed where he certainly was going to be hanged, a man got upon a stool, the stool that would serve Rouletabille a few moments later, with his arm raised, and drove with a few blows of a mallet a great ring-bolt into a beam above his head. The reporter's eyes, which had not lost their habit of taking everything in, rested again on a coarse canvas sack that lay on the ground. The young man felt a slight tremor, for he saw quickly that the sack swathed the human form. He turned his head away, but only to confront another empty sack that was intended for him. Then he closed his eyes. The sound of music came from somewhere outside, notes of the balalaika. He said to himself, "Well, we certainly are in Finland," for he knew that if the guzla is Russian, the balalaika certainly is Finnish. It is a kind of accordion that the peasants pick plaintively in the doorways of their tubas. He had seen and heard them the afternoon that he went to Pergolovo, and also a little further away, on the Vyborg line. He pictured to himself the ruined structure where he now found himself, shut in with the revolutionary tribunal, as it must appear from the outside to passers-by, unsinister, like many others near it, sheltering under its decaying roof a few homes of humble workers, resting now as they played the balalaika at their thresholds, with the day's labor over. And suddenly, from the ineffable peace of his last evening, while the balalaika mourned, and the man overhead tested the solidity of his ring-bolt, a voice outside, the grave, deep voice of Annouchka, sang for the little Frenchman. "For whom weave we now the crown of lilac, rose, and thyme? When my hand falls lingering down, who then will bring your crown of lilac, rose, and thyme? Oh, that someone among you would hear and come, and my lonely hand would press and shed the friendly tear, for alone at the end I stand. Who now will bring the crown of lilac, rose, and thyme?" Rouletabille listened to the voice dying away with the last sob of the balalaika. "It is too sad," he said, rising. "Let us go," and he wavered a little. They came to search him. All was ready above. They pushed him gently toward the shed. When he was under the ring-bolt, near the stool, they made him turn around, and they read him something in Russian, doubtless less for him than for those there who did not understand French. Rouletabille had hard work to hold himself erect. The gentleman of the Neva said to him further, "Monsieur, we now read you the final formula. It asks you to say whether, before you die, you have anything you wish to add to what we know concerning the sentence which has been passed upon you." Rouletabille thought that his saliva, which at that moment he had the greatest difficulty in swallowing, would not permit him to utter a word. But disdain of such a weakness, when he recalled the coolness of so many illustrious condemned people in their last moments, brought him the last strength needed to maintain his reputation. "Why," said he, "this sentence is not wrongly drawn up. I blame it only for being too short. Why has there been no mention of the crime I committed in contriving the tragic death of poor Michael Korsakoff?" "Michael Korsakoff was a wretch," pronounced the vindictive voice of the young man who had presided at the trial, and who at this supreme moment happened to be face to face with Rouletabille. "Koupriane's police, by killing that man, ridded us of a traitor." Rouletabille uttered a cry of joy, and while he had some reason for believing that at the point he had reached now of his too short career only misfortune could befall him, yet here Providence, in his infinite grace, sent him before he died this ineffable consolation, the certainty that he had not been mistaken. "Pardon, pardon," he murmured in an excess of joy which stifled him almost as much as the wretched rope would shortly do that they were getting ready behind him. "Pardon, one second yet, one little second. Then, messieurs, then, we are agreed in that, are we? This Michael Nikolaevich, was the last of the traitors?"
"The first," said the heavy voice.
"It is the same thing, my dear monsieur, a traitor, a wretched traitor," continued Rouletabille.
"A poisoner," replied the voice.
"A vulgar poisoner. Is that not so? But tell me how, a vulgar poisoner who, under cover of nihilism, worked for his own petty ends, worked for himself and betrayed you all." Now Rouletabille's voice rose like a fanfare. Someone said, "He did not deceive us long. Our enemies themselves undertook his punishment." "It was I," cried Rouletabille, radiant again. "It was I who wound up that career. I tell you, that was managed right. It was I who rid you of him. Ah, I knew well enough, messieurs, at the bottom of my heart, I knew that I could not be mistaken. Two and two make four always, don't they? And Rouletabille is always Rouletabille. Messieurs, it is right, after all." But it was probable that it was also all wrong, for the gentleman of the Neva came up to him hat in hand and said, "Monsieur, you know now why the witnesses at your trial did not raise a fact against you that, on the contrary, was entirely in your favor. Now it only remains for us to execute the sentence which is entirely justified on other grounds." "Ah, but wait a little. What the devil? Now that I am sure I have not been mistaken, and that I have been myself, Rouletabille, all the time, I cling to life a little. Oh, very much." A hostile murmur showed the condemned man that the patience of his judges was getting near its limit. "Monsieur," interposed the president, "we know that you do not belong to the orthodox religion. Nevertheless, we will bring a priest if you wish it." "Yes, yes, that is it. Go for the priest," cried Rouletabille, and he said to himself, "It is so much time gained." One of the revolutionaries started over to a little cabin that had been transformed into a chapel, while the rest of them looked at the reporter with a good deal less sympathy than they had been showing. If his bravado had impressed them agreeably in the trial-room, they were beginning to be rather disgusted by his cries, his protestations, and all the maneuvers by which he so apparently was trying to hold off the hour of his death. But all at once Rouletabille jumped up onto the fatal stool. They believed he had decided finally to make an end of the comedy and die with dignity, but he had mounted there only to give them a discourse. "Messieurs, understand me now. If it is true that you are not suppressing me in order to avenge Michael Nikolaevitch, then why do you hang me? Why do you inflict this odious punishment on me? Because you accuse me of causing Natasha Fedorovna's arrest? Truly, I have been awkward of that, and that alone I accuse myself." "It was you, with your revolver, who gave the signal to Koupriane's agents. You have done the dirty work for the police." Rouletabille tried vainly to protest, to explain, to say that his revolver shot, on the contrary, had saved the revolutionaries. But no one cared to listen, and no one believed him. "Here is the priest, monsieur," said the gentleman of the Neva. "One second. These are my last words, and I swear to you that after this I will pass the rope about my neck myself. But listen to me. Listen to me closely. Natasha Fedorovna was the most precious recruit you had, was she not?" "A veritable treasure," declared the president, his voice more and more impatient. "It was a terrible blow, then," continued the reporter. "A terrible blow for you, this arrest." "Terrible," some of them ejaculated. "Do not interrupt me. Very well, then. I am going to say this to you. If I ward off this blow, if, after having been the unintentional cause of Natasha's arrest, I have the daughter of General Trebassof set at liberty, and that within 24 hours, what do you say? Would you still hang me?" The president, he who had the Christ-like countenance, said, "Messieurs, Natasha Fedorovna has fallen the victim of terrible machinations whose mystery we so far have not been able to penetrate. She is accused of trying to poison her father and her stepmother, and under such conditions that it seems impossible for human reason to demonstrate the contrary. Natasha Fedorovna herself, crushed by the tragic occurrence, was not able to answer her accusers at all, and her silence has been taken for a confession of guilt. Messieurs, Natasha Fedorovna will be started for Siberia tomorrow. We can do nothing for her. Natasha Fedorovna is lost to us." Then, with a gesture to those who surrounded Rouletabille, "Do your duty, messieurs." "Pardon, pardon. But if I do prove the innocence of Natasha..." "Just wait, messieurs. There is only I who can prove that innocence. You lose Natasha by killing me." "If you had been able to prove that innocence, monsieur, the thing would already be done. You would not have waited." "Pardon, pardon. It is only at this moment that I have become able to do it." "How is that?" "It is because I was sick, you see, very seriously sick. That affair of Michael Nikolaevitch and the poison that still continued after he was dead simply robbed me of all my powers. Now that I am sure I have not been the means of killing an innocent man, I am Rouletabille again. It is not possible that I shall not find the way, that I shall not see through this mystery. The terrible voice of the Christ-like figure said monotonously, "Do your duty, messieurs." "Pardon, pardon. This is of great importance to you, and the proof is that you have not yet hanged me. You were not so procrastinating with my predecessor, were you? You have listened to me because you have hoped. Very well. Let me think. Let me consider. Oh, the devil! I was there myself at the fatal luncheon, and I know better than anyone else all that happened there. 5 minutes. I demand 5 minutes of you. It is not much. 5 little minutes." These last words of the condemned man seemed to singularly influence the revolutionaries. They looked at one another in silence. Then the president took out his watch and said, "5 minutes. We grant them to you." "Put your watch here, here on this nail. It is 7:05, eh? You will give me until the hour?" "Yes, until the hour. The watch itself will strike when the hour has come." "Ah, it strikes, like the general's watch, then. Very well, here we are." Then there was the curious spectacle of Rouletabille standing on the hangman's stool, the fatal rope hanging above his head, his legs crossed, his elbow on his knees in that eternal attitude which art has always given to human thought, his fists under his jaws, his eyes fixed all around him, all those young men intent on his silence, not moving a muscle, turned into statues themselves that they might not disturb the statue which thought and thought. End of chapter 17. Read by Don W. Jenkins, Rancho San Diego, California, shaggybark.blogspot.com. Section 18 of The Secret of the Night by Gaston LaRue. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Don W. Jenkins. Chapter 18. A Singular Experience. The 5 minutes ticked away, and the watch commenced to strike the hour's 7 strokes. Did it sound the death of Rouletabille? Perhaps not, for at the first silver tinkle they saw Rouletabille shake himself and raise his head, with his face alight and his eyes shining. They saw him stand up, spread out his arms, and cry, "I have found it!" Such joy shone in his countenance that there seemed to be an aureole around him, and none of those there doubted that he had the solution of the impossible problem. "I have found it! I have found it!" They gathered around him. He waved them away as in a waking dream. "Give me room! I have found it, if my experiment works out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What was he doing? He counted his steps now in long paces as in dueling preliminaries, and the others, all of them, followed him in silence, puzzled but without protest, as if they too were caught in the same strange daydream. Steadily counting his steps, he crossed thus the court, which was vast. 40, 41, 42, he cried excitedly. "This is certainly strange and very promising." The others, although they did not understand, refrained from questioning him, for they saw there was nothing to do but let him go ahead without interruption, just as care is taken not to wake a somnambulist abruptly. They had no mistrust of his motives, for the idea was simply untenable that Rouletabille was fool enough to hope to save himself from them by an imbecile subterfuge. No, they yielded to the impression his inspired countenance gave them, and several were so affected that they unconsciously repeated his gestures. Thus Rouletabille reached the edge of the court where judgment had been pronounced against him. There he had to mount a rickety flight of stairs whose steps he counted. He reached a corridor, but moving away from the side where the door was opening to the exterior, he turned toward a staircase leading to the upper floor and still counted the steps as he climbed them. Some of the company followed him, others hurried ahead of him, but he did not seem aware of either the one or the other as he walked along, living only in his thoughts. He reached the landing-place, hesitated, pushed open a door, and found himself in a room furnished with a table, 2 chairs, a mattress, and a huge cupboard. He went to the cupboard, turned the key, and opened it. The cupboard was empty. He closed it again and put the key in his pocket. Then he went out onto the landing-place again. There he asked for the key of the chamber door he had just left. They gave it to him, and he locked that door and put that key also in his pocket. Now he returned into the court. He asked for a chair. It was brought to him. Immediately he placed his head in his hands, thinking hard, took the chair and carried it over a little behind the shed. The Nihilists watched everything he did, and they did not smile, because men do not smile when death waits at the end of things, however foolish. Finally Rouletabille spoke. "Messieurs," he said, his voice low and shaken, because he knew that now he touched the decisive minute, after which there could only be an irrevocable fate. "Messieurs, in order to continue my experiment, I am obliged to go through movements that might suggest to you the idea of an attempt at escape, or evasion. I hope you don't regard me as fool enough to have any such thought."
"Oh, monsieur," said the chief, "you are free to go through all the maneuvers you wish. No one escapes us. Outside we should have you within arm's reach, quite as well as here. And besides, it is entirely impossible to escape from here."
"Very well. Then it is understood. In such a case, I ask you now to remain just where you are, and not to budge, whatever I do, if you don't wish to inconvenience me. Only please send someone now up to the next floor where I am going to go again, and let him watch what happens from there, but without interfering. And don't speak a word to me during the experiment." Two of the revolutionaries went to the upper floor, and opened a window in order to keep track of what went on in the court. All now showed their intense interest in the acts and gestures of Rouletabille. The reporter placed himself in the shed between his death stool and his hanging rope. "Ready," said he, "I am going to begin." And suddenly he jumped like a wild man, crossed the court in a straight line like a flash, disappeared in the tuba, bounded up the staircase, felt in his pocket and drew out the keys, opened the door of the chamber he had locked, closed it and locked it again, turned right about face, came down again in the same haste, reached the court, and this time swerved to the chair, went around it, still running, and returned at the same speed to the shed. He no sooner reached there than he uttered a cry of triumph as he glanced at the watch hanging from a post. "I have won," he said, and threw himself with a happy thrill upon the fatal scaffold. They surrounded him, and he read the liveliest curiosity in all their faces. Panting still from his mad dash, he asked for two words apart with the chief of the secret committee. The man who had pronounced judgment and who had the bearing of Jesus advanced, and there was a brief exchange of words between the two young men. The others drew back and waited at a distance, in impressive silence, the outcome of this mysterious colloquy, which certainly would settle Rouletabille's fate. "Messieurs," said the chief, "the young Frenchman is going to be allowed to leave. We give him 24 hours to set Natasha Fedorovna free. In 24 hours, if he has not succeeded, he will return here to give himself up." A happy murmur greeted these words. The moment their chief spoke thus, they felt sure of Natasha's fate. The chief added, "As the liberation of Natasha Fedorovna will be followed, the young Frenchman says, by that of our companion Mathieu, we decide that, if these two conditions are fulfilled, M. Joseph Rouletabille is allowed to return in entire security to France, which he ought never to have left." Two or three only of the group said, "That lad is playing with us. It is not possible." But the chief declared, "Let the lad try. He accomplishes miracles." End of chapter 18. Read by Don W. Jenkins, Rancho San Diego, California. shaggybark.blogspot.com. Section 19 of The Secret of the Night by Gaston Leroux. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Don W. Jenkins. Chapter 19. The Tsar. "I have escaped by remarkable luck," cried Rouletabille, as he found himself in the middle of the night at the corner of the Catherine and the Aptekarsky Perelouk canals, while the mysterious carriage which had brought him there returned rapidly toward the Grand Ecurie. "What a country! What a country!" He ran a little way to the Grand Morskaya, which was near, entered the hotel like a bomb, dragged the interpreter from his bed, demanded that his bill be made out, and that he be told the time of the next train for Tsarskoye Chelo. The interpreter told him that he could not have his bill at such an hour, that he could not leave town without his passport, and that there was no train for Tsarskoye Chelo, and Rouletabille made an outcry that woke the whole hotel. The guests, fearing always un scandal, kept close to their rooms. But Monsieur le Directeur came down, trembling. When he found all that it was about, he was inclined to be peremptory, but Rouletabille, who had seen Michael Strogoff played, cried, "Service of the Tsar," which turned him submissive as a sheep. He made out the young man's bill and gave him his passport, which had been brought back by the police during the afternoon. Rouletabille rapidly wrote a message to Koupriane's address, which the messenger was directed to have delivered without a moment's delay, under the pain of death. The manager humbly promised, and the reporter did not explain that by pain of death he referred to his own. Then, having ascertained that as a matter of fact the last train had left for Tsarskoye Selo, he ordered a carriage and hurried to his room to pack. And he, ordinarily so detailed, so particular in his affairs, threw things every which way, linen, garments, with kicks and shoves. It was a relief after the emotions he had gone through. "What a country!" he never ceased to ejaculate. "What a country!" Then the carriage was ready, with two little Finnish horses whose gait he knew well, an evil-looking driver who nonetheless would get him there, the trunk, roubles to the domestics, "Spasibo, barina, spasibo." "Thank you, monsieur, thank you." The interpreter asked what address he should give the driver. "The home of the Tsar." The interpreter hesitated, believing it to be an unbecoming pleasantry, then waved vaguely to the driver, and the horses started. "What a curious trot! We have no idea of that in France," thought Rouletabille. "France, France, Paris, is it possible that soon I shall be back? And that dear lady in black! Ah, at the first opportunity I must send her a dispatch of my return, before she receives those icons and the letters announcing my death. Scan, scan, scan! Hurry!" The Itzvachik pounded his horses, crowding past the dvorniks who watched at the corners of the houses during the St. Petersburg night. "Dirigi, dirigi, dirigi! Look out!" The country, somber in the somber night, the vast open country, what monotonous desolation! Rapidly, through the vast silent spaces, the little car glided over the lonely route into the black arms of the pines. Rouletabille, holding on to his seat, looked about him. "God, this is as sad as a funeral display!" Little frozen huts, no larger than tombs, occasionally indicated the road. But there was no mark of life in that country except the noise of the journey and the two beasts with steaming coats. Crack! One of the shafts broken. What a country! To hear Rouletabille, one would suppose that only in Russia could the shaft of a carriage break. The repair was difficult and crude with bits of rope, and from then on the journey was slow and cautious after the frenzied speed. In vain Rouletabille reasoned with himself. "You will arrive anyway before morning. You cannot wake the Emperor in the dead of night." His impatience knew no reason. What a country! What a country! After some other petty adventures, they ran into a ravine and had tremendous difficulty rescuing the trunk, they arrived at Tsarskoye Selo at 7:15. Even here the country was not pleasant. Rouletabille recalled the bright awakening of the French country. Here it seemed there was something more dead than death. It was this little city with its streets where no one passed, not a soul, not a phantom, with its houses so impenetrable, the windows even of glazed glass and further blinded by the morning hoarfrost shutting out light more thoroughly than closed eyelids. Behind them he pictured to himself a world unknown, a world which neither spoke nor wept nor laughed, a world in which no living chord resounded. What a country! Where is the chateau? I do not know. I have been here only once in the marshal's carriage. I do not know the way. Not the great palace. The idiot of the driver has brought me to this great palace in order to see it, I haven't a doubt. Does Rouletabille look like a tourist? Durak! The home of the Tsar, I tell you, the Tsar's residence, the place where the little father lives, Shea Batouchka. The driver lashed his ponies. He drove past all the streets. Stoy! Stop! Cried Rouletabille.
A gate. A soldier, musket at shoulder, bayonet in play. Another gate. Another soldier. Another bayonet.
A park with walls around it, and around the walls more soldiers. No mistake, here is the place, thought Rouletabille. There was only one prisoner for whom such pains would be taken. He advanced towards the gate. Ah! They crossed bayonets under his nose. Halt! No fooling, Joseph Rouletabille of La Poque. A subaltern came from a guardhouse and advanced toward him. Explanation evidently was going to be difficult. The young man saw that if he demanded to see the Tsar they would think him crazed and that would further complicate matters. He asked for the Grand Marshal of the court. They replied that he could get the Marshal's address in Tsarskoye, but the subaltern turned his head. He saw someone advancing. It was the Grand Marshal himself. Some exceptional service called him, without doubt, very early to the court.
"Why, what are you doing here? You are not gone yet, then, Monsieur Rouletabille?"
"Politeness before everything, Monsieur le Grand Marechal. I would not go before saying au revoir to the Emperor. Be so good, since you are going to him and he has risen, you yourself have told me he rises at 7, be so good as to say to him that I wish to pay my respects before leaving."
"Your scheme, doubtless, is to speak to him once more regarding Natasha Feodorovna?"
"Not at all. Tell him, Excellency, that I am come to explain the mystery of the eiderdowns."
"Ah, ah, the eiderdowns. You know something?"
"I know all." The Grand Marshal saw that the young man did not pretend. He asked him to wait a few minutes and vanished into the park. A quarter of an hour later, Joseph Rouletabille of the journal L'Epoque was admitted into the cabinet that he knew well from the first interview he had had there with His Majesty. The simple workroom of a country house, a few pictures on the walls, portraits of the Tsarina and the imperial children on the table, Oriental cigarettes in the tiny gold cups. Rouletabille was far from feeling any assurance, for the Grand Marshal had said to him, "Be cautious. The Emperor is in a terrible humor about you." A door opened and closed. The Tsar made a sign to the Marshal, who disappeared. Rouletabille bowed low, then watched the Emperor closely. Quite apparently, His Majesty was displeased. The face of the Tsar, ordinarily so calm, so pleasant and smiling, was severe, and his eyes had an angry light. He seated himself and lighted a cigarette.
"Monsieur," he commenced, "I am not otherwise sorry to see you before your departure in order to say to you myself that I am not at all pleased with you. If you were one of my subjects, I would have already started you on the road to the Ural Mountains."
"I remove myself farther, sire."
"Monsieur, I pray you not to interrupt me and not to speak unless I ask you a question."
"Oh, pardon, sire, pardon."
"I am not duped by the pretext you have offered Monsieur le Grand Marechal in order to penetrate here."
"It is not a pretext, sire."
"Again." "Oh, pardon, sire, pardon. I say to you that, called here to aid me against my enemies, they themselves have not found a stronger or more criminal support than in you."
"Of what am I accused, sire?"
"Coupriane."
"Ah, ah, pardon."
"My chief of police justly complains that you have traversed all his designs, and that you have taken it upon yourself to ruin them. First you removed his agents, who inconvenienced you, it seems. Then, the moment that he had the proof in hand of the abominable alliance of Natasha Feodorovna with the Nihilists, who attempted the assassination of her father, your intervention has permitted that proof to escape him. And you have boasted of the feat, monsieur, so that we can only consider you responsible for the attempts that followed. Without you, Natasha would not have attempted to poison her father. Without you, they would not have sent to find physicians who could blow up the Dasha des Iles. Finally, no later than yesterday, when this faithful servant of mine had set a trap they could not have escaped from, you have had the audacity, you, to warn them of it. They owe their escape to you. Monsieur, these are attempts against the security of the state which deserves the heaviest punishment. Why, you went out one day from here promising me to save General Trebassof from all the plotting assassins who lurked about him, and then you play the game of the assassins. Your conduct is as miserable as that of Natasha Feodorovna is monstrous." The Emperor ceased and looked at Rouletabille, who had not lowered his eyes.
"What can you say for yourself? Speak now."
"I can only say to Your Majesty that I come to take leave of you because my task here is finished. I have promised you the life of General Trebassof, and I bring it to you. He runs no danger any more. I say further to Your Majesty that there exists nowhere in the world a daughter more devoted to her father, even to the death, a daughter more sublime than Natasha Feodorovna, nor more innocent."
"Be careful, monsieur. I inform you that I have studied this affair personally and very closely. You have the proofs of these statements you advance?"
"Yes, sire."
"And I have the proofs that Natasha Feodorovna is a renegade." At this contradiction, uttered in a firm voice, the Emperor stirred, a flush of anger and of outraged majesty on his face. But after this first movement he succeeded in controlling himself, opened a drawer brusquely, took out some papers, and threw them on the table. "Here they are." Rouletabille reached for the papers. "You do not read Russian, monsieur. I will translate their purport for you. Know, then, that there has been a mysterious exchange of letters between Natasha Feodorovna and the Central Revolutionary Committee,
and that these letters show the daughter of General Trebassof to be in perfect accord with the assassins of her father for the execution of their abominable project.
The death of the general? I declare to your majesty that that is not possible.
Obstinate man, I will read.
Useless, sire, it is impossible. There may be in them the question of a project, but I am greatly surprised if these conspirators have been sufficiently imprudent to write in those letters that they count on Natasha to poison her father.
That, as a matter of fact, is not written, and you yourself are responsible for it not being there. It does not follow any the less that Natasha Fedorovna had an understanding with the Nihilists.
That is correct, sire.
Ah, you confess that?
I do not confess. I simply affirm that Natasha had an understanding with the Nihilists,
who plotted their abominable attacks against the ex-governor of Moscow.
Sire, since Natasha had an understanding with the Nihilists, it was not to kill her father, but to save him. And the project of which you hold here the proofs, but of whose character you are unaware, is to end the attacks of which you speak instantly.
You say that.
I speak the truth, sire.
Where are the proofs? Show me your papers.
I have none. I have only my word.
That is not sufficient.
It will be sufficient once you have heard me.
I listen.
Sire, before revealing to you a secret on which depends the life of General Trebassof, you must permit me some questions. Your Majesty holds the life of the general very dear.
What has that to do with it?
Pardon. I desire that Your Majesty assure me on that point.
The general has protected my throne. He has saved the empire from one of the greatest dangers that it has ever run. If the servant who has done such a service should be rewarded by death, by the punishment that the enemies of my people prepare for him in darkness, I should never forgive myself. There have been too many martyrs already.
You have replied to me, sire, in such a way that you make me understand there is no sacrifice, even to the sacrifice of your amour propre, the greatest a ruler can suffer, no sacrifice too dear to ransom from death one of these martyrs.
Ah, ah, these gentlemen lay down conditions to me. Money, money, they need money. And at how much did they rate the head of the general?
Sire, that does not touch your majesty, and I never will come to offer you such a bargain. That matter concerns only Natasha Fyodorovna, who has offered her fortune.
Her fortune, but she has nothing.
She will have one at the death of the general. Now, she engages to give it all to the Revolutionary Committee the day the general dies, if he dies a natural death. The Emperor rose, greatly agitated.
To the Revolutionary Party, what do you tell me? The fortune of the general.
Eh, but these are great riches. Sire, I have told you the secret. You alone should know it and guard it forever. And I have your sacred word that when the hour comes you will let the prize go where it is promised. If the general ever learns of such a thing, such a treaty, he would easily arrange that nothing should remain, and he would denounce his daughter who has saved him, and then he would promptly be the prey of his enemies and yours, from whom you wish to save him. I have told the secret not to the emperor, but to the representative of God on the Russian earth. I have confessed it to the priest, who is bound to forget the words uttered only before God. Allow Natasha Fedorovna her own way, sire. And her father, your servant, whose life is so dear to you, is saved. At the natural death of the general, his fortune will go to his daughter, who has disposed of it. Rouletabille stopped a moment to judge the effect produced. It was not good. The face of his august listener was more and more in a frown. The silence continued, and now the reporter did not dare to break it. He waited. Finally, the emperor rose and walked forward and backward across the room, deep in thought. For a moment he stopped at the window and waved paternally to the little Tsarevich who played in the park with the grand duchesses. But then he returned to Rouletabille and pinched his ear.
"But tell me, how have you learned all this? And who then has poisoned the general and his wife in the kiosk, if not Natasha?"
"Natasha is a saint. It is nothing, sire, that she has been raised in luxury and vows herself to misery. But it is sublime that she guards in her heart the secret of her sacrifice from everyone, and in spite of all, because secrecy is necessary and has been required of her. I see her guarding it before her father, who has been brought to believe in the dishonor of his daughter, and still to be silent when a word would have proved her innocent, guarding it face to face with her fiancé, whom she loves and repulses because marriage is forbidden to the girl who is supposed to be rich and who will be poor. Guarding it above all, and guarding it still in the depths of the dungeon,
and ready to take the road to Siberia under the accusation of assassination, because that ignominy is necessary for the safety of her father. That, sire, oh, sire, do you see?
But you, how have you been able to penetrate into this guarded secret?
By watching her eyes, by observing, when she believed herself alone, the look of terror and the gleams of love, and beyond all by looking at her when she was looking at her father. Ah, sire, there were moments when on her mystic face one could read the wild joy and devotion of the martyr. Then, by listening and by piecing together scraps of phrases inconsistent with the idea of treachery, but which immediately acquired a meaning if one thought of the opposite, of sacrifice. And that is it, sire. Consider always the alternative motive. What I finally could see myself, the others who had a fixed opinion about Natasha could not see. And why had they their fixed opinion? Simply because the idea of compromise with the nihilists aroused at once the idea of complicity. For such people it is always the same thing. They never can see but the one side of a situation. But nevertheless the situation had two sides, as all situations have. The question was simple. The compromise was certain. But why had Natasha compromised herself with the nihilists? Was it necessary in order to lose her father? Might it not be, on the contrary, in order to save him? When one has rendezvous with an enemy, it is not necessarily to enter into his game. Sometimes it is to disarm him with an offer. Between these two hypotheses, which I alone took the trouble to examine, I did not hesitate long, because Natasha's every attitude proclaimed her innocence. And her eyes, sire, in which one read purity and love, prevailed always with me against all the passing appearances of disgrace and crime. I saw that Natasha negotiated with them. But what had she to place in the scales against the life of her father? Nothing, except the fortune that she would have one day. Some words she spoke about the impossibility of immediate marriage, about poverty which could always knock at the door of any mansion, remarks that I was able to overhear between Natasha and Boris Murazov, which to him meant nothing, put me definitely on the right road. And I was not long in ascertaining that the negotiations in this formidable affair were taking place in the very house of Trebisov, pursued without by the incessant spying of Koupriane, who sought to surprise her in company with the nihilists, watched closely too by the jealous supervision of Boris, who was jealous of Michael Nikolaevich. She had to seize the only opportunities possible for such negotiations, at night, in her own home, the sole place where by the very audacity of it she was able to play her part in any security. Michael Nikolaevich knew Annouchka. There was certainly the point of departure for the negotiations which that felon officer, traitor to all sides, worked at will toward the realization of his own infamous project. I do not think that Michael ever confided to Natasha that he was, from the very first, the instrument of the revolutionaries. Natasha, who sought to get in touch with the revolutionary party, had to entrust him with a correspondence for Annouchka, following which he assumed direction of the affair, deceiving the nihilists, who, in their absolute penury, following the revolt, had been seduced by the proposition of General Trebisov's daughter, and deceiving Natasha, whom he pretended to love and by whom he believed himself loved. At this point in the affair, Natasha came to understand that it was necessary to propitiate Michael Nikolaevich, her indispensable intermediary, and she managed to do it so well that Boris Murazov felt the blackest jealousy. On his side, Michael came to believe that Natasha would have no other husband than himself, but he did not propose to marry a penniless girl. And fatally, it followed that Natasha, in that infernal intrigue, negotiated for the life of her father through the agency of a man who, underhandedly, sought to strike at the general himself because the immediate death of her father before the negotiation was completed would enrich Natasha, who had given Michael so much to hope. That frightful tragedy, sire, in which we have lived our most painful hours appeared to me, confident of Natasha's innocence, as absolutely simple as for the others it seemed complicated. Natasha believed she had in Michael Nikolaevich a man who worked for her, but he worked only for himself. The day that I was convinced of it, sire, by my examination of the approach to the balcony, I had a mind to warn Natasha, to go to her and say, "Get rid of that man, he will betray you. If you need an agent, I am at your service." But that day at Krestowsky, destiny prevented my rejoining Natasha, and I must attribute it to destiny, which would not permit the loss of that man. Michael Nikolaevich, who was a traitor, was too much in the combination, and if he had been rejected, he would have ruined everything. I caused him to disappear. The great misfortune, then, was that Natasha, holding me responsible for the death of a man she believed innocent, never wished to see me again, and when she did see me refused to have any conversation with me because I proposed that I take Michael's place for her with the revolutionaries. She would have nothing to do with me in order to protect her secret. Meantime, the Nihilists believed they were betrayed by Natasha when they learned of the death of Michael, and they undertook to avenge him. They seized Natasha and bore her off by force. The unhappy girl learned then, that same evening, of the attack which destroyed the datcha and happily still spared her father. This time she reached a definite understanding with the revolutionary party. Her bargain was made. I offer you for proof of it only her attitude when she was arrested, and, even in that moment, her sublime silence. While Rouletabille urged his view, the Emperor let him talk on and on, and now his eyes were dim.
"Is it possible that Natasha has not been the accomplice in all of Michael Nikolaevich?" he demanded. "It was she who opened her father's house to him that night. If she was not his accomplice, she would have mistrusted him. She would have watched him."
"Sire, Michael Nikolaevich was a very clever man. He knew so well how to play upon Natasha and Annouchka, in whom she placed all her hope. It was from Annouchka that she wished to hold the life of her father. It was the word, the signature of Annouchka, that she demanded before giving her own. The evening Michael Nikolaevich died, he was charged to bring her that signature. I know it myself because, pretending drunkenness, I was able to overhear enough of a conversation between Annouchka and a man whose name I must conceal. Yes, that last evening, Michael Nikolaevich, when he entered the datcha, had the signature in his pocket, but also he carried the weapon or the poison with which he already had attempted and was resolved to reach the father of her whom he believed was assuredly to be his wife.
You speak now of a paper very precious that I regret not to possess, monsieur, said the Tsar coldly, because that paper alone would have proved to me the innocence of your protégé.
If you have it not, sire, you know well that it is because I have wished you to have it. The corpse had been searched by Katharina, the little Bohemian, and I, sire, prevented Koupriane from finding that signature in Katharina's possession. In saving the secret, I have saved General Trebisov's life, who would have preferred to die rather than accept such an arrangement. The Tsar stopped Rouletabille in his enthusiastic outburst.
All that would be very beautiful and perhaps admirable, said he, more and more coldly, because he had entirely recovered himself, if Natasha had not herself with her own hand poisoned her father and her stepmother, always with arsenate of soda.
Oh, some of that had been left in the house, replied Rouletabille. They had not given me all of it for the analysis after the first attempt, but Natasha is innocent of that, sire. I swear it to you. As true as that, I have certainly escaped being hanged.
How hanged?
Oh, it has not amounted to much now, Your Majesty. And Rouletabille recounted his sinister adventure up to the moment of his death, or rather, up to the moment when he had believed he was going to die. The Emperor listened to the young reporter with complete stupefaction. He murmured, "Poor lad!" Then suddenly, "But how have you managed to escape them?"
Sire, they have given me 24 hours for you to set Natasha at liberty, that is to say, that you restore her to her rights, all her rights, and she to be always the recognized heiress of Trebisov. Do you understand me, sire?
I will understand you, perhaps, when you have explained to me how Natasha has not poisoned her father and stepmother.
There are some things so simple, sire, that one is able to think of them only with a rope around one's neck. But let us reason it out. We have here four persons, two of whom have been poisoned, and the other two with them have not been. Now it is certain that of the four persons the general has not wished to poison himself, that his wife has not wished to poison the general, and that, as for me, I have not wished to poison anybody. That, if we are absolutely sure of it, leaves as the poisoner only Natasha. That is so certain, so inevitable, that there is only one case, one alone, where, in such conditions, Natasha would not be regarded as the poisoner.
I confess that, logically, I do not see, said the Tsar, anything beyond that, but more and more of a tangle. What is it?
Logically, the only case would be that where no one had been poisoned, that is to say, where no one had taken any poison.
But the presence of the poison has been established, cried the Emperor.
Still, the presence of the poison proves only its presence, not the crime. Both poison and ipecac were found in the stomach expulsions, from which a crime has been concluded. What state of affairs was necessary for there to have been no crime? Simply that the poison should have appeared in the expulsions after the ipecac. Then there would have been no poisoning, but everybody would believe that there had been. And for that, someone would have poured the poison into the expulsions.
The Tsar never quitted Rouletabille's eyes.
"That is extraordinary," said he, "but of course it is possible. In any case, it is still only a hypothesis."
"And so long as it could be an hypothesis that no one thought of it, it could be just that, sire. But if I am here, it is because I have the proof that that hypothesis corresponds to the reality. That necessary proof of Natasha's innocence, Your Majesty, I have found with the rope around my neck. Ah, I tell you, it was time. What has hindered us hitherto, I do not say to realize, but even to think of that hypothesis. Simply that we thought the illness of the general had commenced before the absorption of the ipecac, since Matrena Petrovna had been obliged to go for it to her medicine closet after his illness commenced, in order to counteract the poison of which she also appeared to be the victim. But if I acquire proof that Matrena Petrovna had the ipecac at hand before the sickness, my hypothesis of pretense at poisoning has irresistible force, because if it was not to use it before, why did she have it with her before? And if it was not that she wished to hide the fact that she had used it before, why did she wish to make believe that she went to find it afterwards? Then, in order to show Natasha's innocence, here is what must be proved: that Matrena Petrovna had the ipecac on her even when she went to look for it."
"Young Rouletabille, I hardly breathe," said the Tsar.
"Breathe, sire. The proof is here. Matrena Petrovna necessarily had the ipecac on her because after the sickness she had not the time for going to find it. Do you understand, sire? Between the moment when she fled from the kiosk and when she returned there, she had not the actual time to go to her medicine chest to find the ipecac."
"How have you been able to compute the time?" asked the Emperor.
"Sire, the Lord God directed, who made me admire Fyodor Fyodorovitch's watch just when we went to read, and to read on the dial of that watch 2 minutes to the hour, and the Lord God directed yet, who, after the scene of the poison, at the time Matrena returned carrying the ipecac publicly, made the hour strike from that watch in the general's pocket. 2 minutes. It was impossible for Matrena to have covered that distance in 2 minutes. She could only have entered the deserted dacha and left it again instantly. She had not taken the trouble to mount to the floor above, where, she told us and repeated when she returned, the ipecac was in the medicine closet. She lied, and if she lied, all is explained. It was the striking of a watch, sire, with a striking apparatus and a sound like the general's, there in the quarters of the revolutionaries, that roused my memory and indicated to me in a second this argument of the time. I got down from my gallows scaffold, Your Majesty, to experiment on that time limit. Oh, nothing and nobody could have prevented my making that experiment before I died, to prove to myself that Rouletabille had all along been right. I had studied the grounds around the dacha enough to be perfectly exact about the distances. I found in the court where I was to be hanged the same number of steps that there were from the kiosk to the steps of the veranda, and as the staircase of the revolutionaries had fewer steps, I lengthened my journey a few steps by walking around a chair. Finally, I attended to the opening and closing of the doors that Matrena would have had to do. I had looked at a watch when I started. When I returned, sire, and looked at the watch again, I had taken 3 minutes to cover the distance, and it is not for me to boast, but I am a little livelier than the excellent Matrena. Matrena had lied. Matrena had simulated the poisoning of the general. Matrena had coolly poured ipecac into the general's glass while we were illustrating with matches a curious enough theory of the nature of the constitution of the empire."
"But this is abominable," cried the Emperor, this time definitely convinced by the intricate argument of Rouletabille. "And what end could this imitation serve?"
"The end of preventing the real crime, the end that she believed herself to have attained, sire, to have Natasha removed forever, Natasha whom she believed capable of any crime."
"Oh, this is monstrous. Fyodor Fyodorovitch has often told me that Matrena loved Natasha sincerely."
"She loved her sincerely up to the day that she believed her guilty. Matrena Petrovna was sure of Natasha's complicity in Michael Nikolaevich's attempt to poison the general. I shared her stupor, her despair, when Fyodor Fyodorovitch took his daughter in his arms after that tragic night and embraced her. He seemed to absolve her. It was then that Matrena resolved within herself to save the general in spite of himself, but I remained persuaded that if she had dared such a plan against Natasha, it would only be because of what she believed definite proof of her stepdaughter's infamy. These papers, sire, that you have shown me, and which show, if nothing more, an understanding between Natasha and the revolutionaries, could only have been in the possession of Michael or of Natasha, Nothing was found in Michael's quarters. Tell me, then, that Matrena found them in Natasha's apartment. Then she did not hesitate.
If one outlined her crime to her, do you believe she would confess it? Asked the Emperor.
I am so sure of it that I have had her brought here. By now Koupriane should be here at the chateau with Matrena Petrovna.
You think of everything, monsieur.
The Tsar moved to ring a bell. Rouletabille raised his hand. Not yet, sire. I ask that you permit me not to be present at the confusion of that brave, heroic, good woman who has loved me much. But before I go, sire, do you promise me?
The Emperor believed that he had not heard correctly or did not grasp the meaning. He repeated what Rouletabille had said. The young reporter repeated it once more.
Do you promise?
No, sire, I am not mad. I dare to ask you that. I have confided my honor to your majesty. I have told you Natasha's secret. Well, now, before Matrena's confession, I dare to ask you. Promise me to forget that secret. It will not suffice merely to give Natasha back again to her father. It is necessary to leave her course open to her, if you really wish to save General Trebassof. What do you decide, sire?
It is the first time anyone has questioned me, monsieur.
Ah, well, it will be the last, but I humbly beg your majesty to reply.
That would be many millions given to the revolution.
Oh, sire, they are not given yet. The general is 65, but he has many years ahead of him, if you wish it. By the time he dies a natural death, if you wish it, your enemies will have disarmed.
My enemies, murmured the Tsar in a low voice.
No, no, my enemies will never disarm. Who then will be able to disarm them? Added he melancholily, shaking his head.
Progress, sire, if you wish it.
The Tsar turned red and looked at the audacious young man who met the gaze of his majesty frankly.
It is kind of you to say that, my young friend, but you speak as a child.
As a child of France to the father of the Russian people.
It was said in a voice so solemn and at the same time so naively touching that the Tsar started. He gazed again for some time in silence at this boy, who this time turned away his brimming eyes.
Progress and pity, sire.
Well, said the Emperor, it is promised.
Rouletabille was not able to restrain a joyous movement hardly in keeping.
You can ring now, sire.
And the Tsar rang.
The reporter passed into a little salon, where he found the marshal, Koupriane, and Matrena Petrovna, who was in a state. She threw a suspicious glance at Rouletabille, who was not treated this morning as the dear little Domovoy Duke. She permitted herself to be conducted, already trembling, before the Emperor.
What happened? Asked Koupriane, agitatedly.
It so happened, my dear Monsieur Koupriane, that I have the pardon of the Emperor for all the crimes you have charged against me, and that I wish to shake hands before I go without any rancor. Monsieur Koupriane, the Emperor will tell you himself that General Trebassof is saved, and that his life will never be in danger any more. Do you know what follows? It follows that you must at once set Matou free, whom I have taken, if you remember, under my protection. Tell him that he is going to make his way to France. I will find him a place on condition that he forgets certain lashes.
Such a promise, such an attitude toward me, cried Koupriane. But I will wait for the Emperor to tell me all these fine things. And your Natasha, what do you do with her?
We release her also, monsieur. Natasha never has been the monster you think.
How can you say that? Someone at least is guilty.
There are two guilty. The first, Monsieur le Maréchal.
What? Cried the marshal.
Monsieur le Maréchal, who had the imprudence to bring such dangerous grapes to the Dacha des Iles,
And the other? Asked Koupriane, more and more anxiously.
Listen there, said Rouletabille, pointing toward the Emperor's cabinet. The sound of tears and sobs reached them. The grief and the remorse of Matrena Petrovna passed the walls of the cabinet. Koupriane was completely disconcerted. Suddenly the Emperor appeared. He was in a state of exaltation such as had never been known in him. Koupriane, dismayed, drew back.
"Monsieur," said the Tsar to him, "I require that Natasha Feodorovna be here within the next 2 hours, and that she be conducted with the honors due to her rank. Natasha is innocent, and we must make reparation to her."
Then, turning toward Rouletabille, "I have learned what she knows and what she owes to you. We owe to you, my young friend."
The Tsar said, "My young friend." Rouletabille, at this last moment, before his departure, spoke Russian.
"Then she knows nothing, sire. That is better, sire, because your majesty and me, we must forget, right from today, that we know anything."
"You are right," said the Tsar thoughtfully. "But, my friend, what am I to do for you?"
"Sire, one favor. Do not let me miss the train at 10:55." And he threw himself on his knees. "Remain on your knees, my friend. You are ready, thus. Monsieur le Maréchal will prepare at once a brevet, which I will immediately sign. Meantime, Monsieur le Maréchal, find me in my own closet one of my St. Anne's collars." And it was thus that Joseph Rouletabille of L'Epoque was created officer of St. Anne of Russia by the Emperor himself, who gave him the accolade. "They combine the whole course of time in this country," thought Rouletabille, pressing his hand to his eyes to hold back the tears. For the train at 10:55 everybody had crowded at Tsarskoye Chelo station. Among those who had come from St. Petersburg to press the young reporter's hand when they learned of his impending departure were Ivan Petrovitch, the jolly counselor of the Emperor, and Athanase Georgievich, the lively advocate so well known for his famous exploits with knife and fork. They had come naturally with all their bandages and dressings, which made them look like glorious ruins. They brought the greetings of Fyodor Fyodorovitch, who still had a little fever, and of Thaddeus Tchitchnikov, the Lithuanian, who had both legs broken. Even after he was in his compartment, Rouletabille had to drink his last drink of champagne. When nothing remained in the bottle and everyone had embraced and re-embraced him, as the train did not start quite yet, Athanase Georgievich opened a second last bottle. It was then that Monsieur le Grand Maréchal arrived, out of breath. They invited him to drink, and he accepted. But he had need to speak with Rouletabille in private, and he drew the reporter, after excuses, out into the corridor.
"It is the Emperor himself who has sent me," said the high dignitary with emotion. "He has sent me about the eiderdowns. You forgot to explain the eiderdowns to him."
"Nyet," replied Rouletabille, laughing. "That is nothing. Nichevo. His Majesty's eiderdowns are of the finest eider, as one of the feathers that you have shown me demonstrates. Well, open them now. They are a cheap imitation, as the second feather proves. The return of the false eiderdowns before evening proves, then, that they hoped the substitution would pass undetected. That is all. Caracho! Collapse of the hoax! Your health! Vive le Tsar! Caracho! Caracho!" The locomotive was puffing when a couple were seen running, a man and a woman. It was Monsieur and Madame Gounsovski. Gounsovski stood on the running board.
"Madame Gounsovski has insisted upon shaking hands. You are very congenial."
"Compliments, madame."
"Tell me, young man, you did wrong to fail dinner at my house yesterday."
"I would have certainly escaped a disagreeable little journey into Finland. I do not regret it, monsieur." The train trembled and moved. They cried, "Vive la France! Vive la Russe!" Athanase Georgievich wept. Matrena Petrovna, at a window of the station whither she had timidly retired, waved a handkerchief to the little Domovoi Duk, who had made her see everything in the right light, and whom she did not dare to embrace after the terrible affair of the false poison and the Tsar's anger. The reporter threw her a respectful kiss. As he said to Gounsovski, there was nothing to be regretted. All the same, as the train took its way toward the frontier, Rouletabille threw himself back on the cushions and said, "Oof!" End of chapter 19. End of The Secret of the Night by Gaston LaRue. Read by Don W. Jenkins, Rancho San Diego, California, shaggybark.blogspot.com.
Summer adventures are better with Minky Couture. From road trips to ball games, beach nights to backyard movies, Minky has you covered. Don't miss the Everywhere blanket, water-resistant, ultra-soft, and made for life on the go. Wherever summer takes you, bring comfort along. MinkyCouture.com, the original best blanket ever.